Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Open Concessions podcast presented by Toyota, featuring a weekly in-depth conversation with a Chicago Cubs-related personality. We are your hosts, Len Casper, Jim DeShays. You know us as the Cubs television tandem. JD, happy December. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving.
I did indeed, Len. See if you can identify this sound.
It sounds like you're drinking coffee or some other beverage.
Taking a sip of hot coffee. We just went for a nice cold weather walk. It's amazing how quickly things have turned around and turned into winter. But yeah, we're great. Thanksgiving was quiet, as you might expect, but great. It was fun. How about you guys?
Yeah, pretty quiet. We did a little Zoom call with family. It was tough not being kind of having the normal Thanksgiving, but you make do. In a year like this. So I guess all in all, staying safe and healthy is the biggest thing. We, knock on wood, we're able to do that. Our guest on this podcast is our good friend, Cubs manager David Ross, and really looking forward to getting Rossi's take a couple of months after a pretty unique first season as a big league manager, to say the very least.
Yeah, he got thrown into the fire, did he not, with all the complications due to the virus. But by all accounts, you know, from people we've talked to, he did a great job down in the clubhouse. But it will be very interesting to hear his take. And I think the most compelling question that I have for Rossi, and if I forget to ask this, remind me, why never Dave? It's David, it's Rossi. And I think people really want to know, why never Dave?
Yeah. No, you're right. Most Davids do become Dave or Davey at some point. Yeah. But, you know, you're right. It's mainly Rossi. He likes that. But yes, good question. I will remind you if it doesn't come up.
You can tell I've done a lot of research. I've prepped hard for this, so I'm ready.
All right. Well, enjoy our chat with Cubs manager David Ross. Rossi, great to talk to you after a couple of months here in the interim. Give us your thoughts now that you've been able to come down a little bit emotionally after a rather unique first year as a big league manager.
Yeah, you know, still very proud. I think, like, looking back at all the challenges that kind of encompassed 2020, especially on the players' side, I'm just so thankful for the group I have still. I mean, listen, you go into spring training with this goal and you're moving forward down in Arizona and things just hit a halt and you're expected to keep your mind and body in tip-top shape because you know at some point that you're going to have to, you know, ramp it back up pretty fast. And to be able to do that with the country shutting down, really the world shutting down and, you know, finding guys to play with and facilities to try to work out with other players and pitchers keeping their arms in shape and being able to come into, you know, what's a second spring training and all the kind of protocols and hoops you have to jump through and be able to overcome a new manager and his shortcomings that they did. Yeah, I don't know, man. I'm just so thankful for how they attacked the season. And, you know, it didn't turn out the way I thought. I look back on just, you know, just some historic down years from guys that've got really good resumes. And I, only thing I think about is how much fun we had. I had a lot of fun, especially early on when we were kind of rolling. And then just how much fun when you look back, if we would have hit it all, just up to like some of these guys, you know, halfway to what their resumes say, it would have been such a fun season. And we, I feel like we'd have done a lot and impressed a lot of people. So, you know, I'm not trying to make excuses. It was unique and 2020 is unique, but, I mean, the feeling still just very proud of that, those guys and my coaching staff, to be honest with you.
Yeah. So you're talking about the struggles of some of your hitters. Do you attribute that to, small sample size in a 60 game season, the oddity because of COVID, which might be a difficult argument to make because other players around the league had good years, yeah. or just that's freaking baseball. Weird things happen and guys have off years.
Yeah, JD, if I could put my finger on it, you know, we were trying to figure it out all season, and you know, I still don't have a real, you know, I think it's a combination of a lot of things, just what we're like in our routine. But like you said, I don't want to sound like any excuses thrown out there. I really just believe that it's unique, and 60 games is such a short amount of time, and the pressure that you felt, these guys, I think, felt trying to produce, and then the window of time starts to shorten, and they just put so much pressure on themselves. You know, I think you sometimes go into teams, when I was a player, and you hope everybody on the team cares as much as you do, or you know, is willing to put in the work. But the one thing I know about our group is it's almost like they care too much. You know, they were fighting so hard for one another, for our organization, for me, I felt like, which is so rewarding, that, you know, I don't know. I don't want to make excuses and blame anything. There's a lot of different circumstances, and I'm trying to, and my first year managing, so I don't have a lot of things to bounce off of from that seat. So yeah, I think it's a combination of a lot of things, and a lot of those fall into the categories that you listed.
It's funny, not ha-ha funny, I guess, but the adage is always pitching and defense wins championships, right?
Right.
You pitched and you played great defense. You won a team gold glove in 2020, and it really underscores that it's kind of about balance, and you do have to score runs too. And when you look at the best teams in baseball, they're able to kind of do all those things, but you have to feel very proud of, you know, cleaning up a lot of the things that did not go well the year before, and particularly on the defensive side. I thought this team was really good.
Yeah, and the base running side as well. Yeah. And I think we had some areas we wanted to improve on, and we did that. So that feels good from a manager standpoint, and very appreciative of my coaches and how they attacked that. I think that stood out to me. But yeah, you know, I look at that and you say that we did win the Central, and we still didn't hit, you know, so mm-hmm. It does win championships, right? It kept us in it. Like, our pitching and our defense kept us in it. When we were just non-existent offensively, we found a way to win. And I think that goes to the work and the character of the guys to continue to fight when things were just off, you know, and it wasn't always pretty, but we found a way to hold on there for that. And as much as we were troubleshooting as fast as we could, from my seat, you know, I'm used to time, right? You want to give the guys time. You want to not panic. And in a 60-game season, I really found a hard time balancing, like, speaking real truths to these guys in moments and yet letting them have some time to figure some stuff out. And we just ran out of time is really what I believe. But, you know, that you're used to 162. And so my first year manager, the last thing I wanted was to be a first year manager and these guys to feel panic or push or unsettled and just a bad stretch of a couple weeks that turned into a month. And now we're kind of scrambling to figure it out. So, you know, that's a lot of probably my own hesitation of just getting in there a little deeper and maybe making some significant changes or having some significant conversations where I was trying to give it time and trust in the guys that had the resumes.
I want to get back to those adjustments and lineups and, you know, how Hap kind of matriculated his way from 9-1. Hayward kind of moved up as his season went along. But I do want to underscore something you said. Even though it was a 60-game season, we do have to remember that, as you said, you won the division. So yep. If the two-game sample size was the Marlins series. And so there's always that battle, right, of, yes, there were things that happened in that series that had happened before and should be of concern. But if there was a bigger picture this year, it's that you were the best team in the division. And so it's like that balance, right, of disappointment that you didn't go deeper, but also understanding that you had a really good year.
Yeah, yeah. And I try to hold on to the positive. It's such a negative game. And you know, I'm going to do that as much as I possibly can, because I don't. You know, it doesn't matter when you got hot. It's the fact that you're kings at the end. So, you know, I again, we had bigger goals in mind. I'm always going to have bigger goals than that. And we didn't show up when, you know, this group is used to showing up in the postseason. We didn't. And, you know, we have to take some long, hard looks at how we continue to get better and maybe just even train and go about our business and make faster adjustments. Right. Those are some things that stood out for me is like, we're going to need to adjust faster. And the small sample size is what it is, but sometimes that may be all you have the last month of the season when you're fighting for something down the stretch and you see a real problem occurring or arising that you need to get on top of as soon as possible. So those are things that stood out to me is we definitely got to find a way to troubleshoot a little faster than we did this past season.
Rossi, a lot of the postmortem on the season, a lot of the analytics in the conversation was that the lineup is kind of too one-dimensional, like a lot of the hitters kind of have the same approach. And the other one was that the Cubs had a hard time with velocity. Fair?
And yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, just my assessment as I look back, some things that I even found important coming in and you know, the messaging that I hit the guys with early on and what I believe in winning, you know, we've got to command the strike zone better for me. I think as a whole, I think when you watch, you know, the playoffs and seeing the teams that if you don't throw it inside that box, you know, they're not going to bite at it. And as hard as it is to hit these days, owning that strike zone is important. And then you know, I may have overpushed the grind at bats, right? We've got some really hitter friendly counts that we didn't do anything in as a group. So I'm trying to take ownership of that, and maybe I don't know that that's not what I believe. I believe in having the right plan, and so I don't ever want that to get, you know, messaging can be funny. Everybody takes things a little bit differently, so I'm looking at how to attack that going into next year. But you know, I think it's one of those things that you're able to have a clearer picture when you look back. And then as far as the velocity goes, you know, I think we might need to have some training methods that can help us and being ready for that type of velocity. And we're in the process of working as an organization of maybe implementing some new training tools that could really help us out and helping us be better on that end.
Two guys in particular I'd mentioned earlier, Happ and Hayward, were kind of middle to bottom of the order hitters. And by the end of the year, they were middle to top. In Hayward's case, I thought he didn't give up one at bat all year. I mean, I don't know how you felt. Just he was the Cubs' best, most consistent hitter and did all those things that you just described about being in favorable counts and then actually did stuff with that. Happ had an interesting year in that he was really good early, and then the league really adjusted to him. Can you talk about those two guys separately and what you saw as the season went on?
Yeah, I thought I'm definitely on board with Jason Hayward was our best at bat throughout the season. I really felt like there was a conscious effort to focus on what he did well, where he saw the ball and liked the ball, and he wasn't going to. There was adamant. He was very adamant about, or I should say, angry when he would chase up out of the zone or get outside of what he knew he did well. And you could see it in his body language, in his actions. There were a few times where he had, you know, either a 3-2 count or two strikes on him, and he chased up out of the zone, and he was, you know, really pissed off. And that's what I want to see is guys that know what they do well and sticking to that plan and having that plan. I thought he did that the best of our group. You know, I moved him up a little bit there at the end just out of, you know, trying to shake some things up. And he likes his spot in the lineup and keeping him comfy. So, but I loved what he did for us this year. Very consistent. And he's such a leader on our team in so many ways. But that was definitely one that stood out to me as well. And then, you know, Happer, I thought jumped on. I thought going into it, Ian was going to be the wild card of our group. We're really going to be able to do something special if he had a great year. And he did. He did just that. You know, moving him, starting him off down in the lineup where we could kind of turn it over and have a really quality at bat in front of KB when he was leading off. And he took to that, took his walks, drove the baseball, and then moving him up a little bit there when he was having some success to that 6-7 hole, I believe, where he started to drive in some runs. I really thought he took off. And then we were just hurting when KB was down of who to have a leadoff guy. And then there's always that extra little bit of pressure. Like, I want to continue to have a great season. You know, the mind plays tricks on you. I saw him get back to a little bit of his old habits of chasing up out of the zone at times, but he reined that back in towards the back end of the season and in the postseason for sure for us. Ian's a quality player, quality human being, good teammate. He's a guy that we're going to rely on for a long time. His power and his strike zone recognition is really something that continues to develop, and he's very thought out in his approach and how he attacks the game and understands what he does well. And so it was nice to see Ian take a step forward for him and his career.
One other guy before JD jumps back in, I want to ask you about is Contreras had an interesting year, Rossi, in that I felt like his best stretch was when he didn't walk. And when guys are hitting and they're not walking, you always get a little nervous. And, you know, he's got a good approach and we'll take his walks. But is that one of those things too, that you got to check yourself a little bit? And when a guy's hitting, he's hitting, and that's good. And you don't, like you said, it's messaging as a hitting coach, whatever. You don't want to get in a guy and say, hey man, you know, you're swinging a lot early, but he was crushing the ball early on, even though he was striking out and he wasn't walking. And so, there's that fine line, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. The only stat that shows up in my column is the W. So I leave him alone while we're doing that. But no, I think Wilson was going to, you know, I moved him around the lineup probably the most. And, you know, you saw there to the end, he was in that 2-3 hole where just could really, you know, he brings a threat. I thought he started to take his walks a lot better towards the back end. Yeah. He understood how they were pitching him. I think, you know, we talked a little bit with him after the season, and he's a guy, he's so competitive that he understands catching and hitting and how the other team's going to attack him. So I felt like there was a stretch there when he struggled the most that he was trying to hit what they were going to throw him rather than staying in his approach and his plan. And once he got back to that on the back end, he turned back into the hitter we know he can be. So he's one that I like to see his at bats, because it's almost like he's in the ring with the other guy and he's fighting that pitcher that day. Everything he does is competition, and he's battling. It's him against the world. And I like that. I like the swag he brings, the intensity he brings. I know sometimes it gets a little bit misinterpreted, I think, and he knows that. We all know that. But he's a guy that has such passion that we needed that. And I thought he put us on his back there late, like that. The home run against the White Sox with a bat flip, is as much as that's not my style, like, I can't love it anymore. You know, like, we needed. We weren't hitting it all coming out of Pittsburgh, and things were going in the wrong direction for us. And I thought he was one of those guys that put us on his back.
That's funny. You talked about the bat flip. I was going to ask you, as you talked about Contreras, is it safe to say that he would be your most high maintenance guy? A lot of conversations.
I think the main thing for me with him, JD, is that when he gets too emotional, when it gets to be just super emotional, he's not as good of a player. And I've talked to him about that the most. As far as he works his tail off, and yeah, we have conversations, but definitely not my highest maintenance player. He's a guy that I think he respects me because I've done the job, and I do value his opinion, because I can ask him real pointed questions in the middle of the battling, and he'll give me some really good feedback. No, man, he is. If you understand where the emotions are coming from, it's a little bit easier to deal with. And I think in this job, I learned early on about setting boundaries with almost every player. And we set some boundaries early on. I told him what I expected when he was out on the field, and what I needed out of him. And if we had a problem with that, he could come and have conversations with me. And, you know, I think he went through some times there where he was trying to navigate all those things and trying to harness that emotion and continue to grow as a Major League Baseball player. And I thought he did a good job for us. I thought he did a real good job. I thought he was one of our leaders, and he worked his tail off with Craig Driver, and we saw his name pop up in a lot of the great accolades that we got defensively. And yeah, man, I'm super proud of him, and you know, he's emotional, but I'd rather that, right, than the other way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. than just a kind of a dead, lifeless kind of guy. Yeah, you love the energy.
Toyotathon is on, and there are great deals on your favorite Toyota models, such as the RAV4, the Highlander, Camry, Corolla, Tundra, Tacoma, and more. That's right, Toyotathon is on. Did I mention every new Toyota comes with Toyota Care? Their 2-year or 25,000-mile maintenance plan. Visit toyota.com for more details and get into your local Chicagoland Toyota dealer today. Toyotathon ends January 4th. Toyota Care covers normal factory scheduled service for 2 years or 25,000 miles, whichever occurs first. See your participating dealer for details.
We hope to have fans back in the ballpark in 2021. And by placing a ticket pack deposit, you'll have the opportunity to purchase tickets before the general single game tickets on sale date. There are 8-game packs and 14-game packs that can be customized to your preferences. For more information, visit cubs.com/ticket packs.
This team did something that probably no professional team has done in 2020, and that is you went through an entire non-bubble season without a positive COVID test on the roster, which is just amazing. And we talked a lot this year about Tommy Hotovy's story, and as awful as it was that he had to go through that, how big an imprint did that story have on the guys, and did it matter?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it definitely mattered. I think where it mattered the most is I saw it in the Zooms during the downtime. I saw him. We talked probably daily, if not every other day, and I saw it. So it just made it real for me when I got ready to address the group. But I want to take a step back on that, and we've gotten so much credit for that. But I have to give all that to, one, our trainers, our doctors, and then, you know, the leadership. Jed and Theo, you guys have no idea how on top of this thing they were from the get-go, and holding guys out from coming in that you thought, oh, no big deal. Hayward's in Chicago. Kipnis is in Chicago. Happer's in Chicago. Just let them come to the field and let them work out. It's not that big a deal. And it was a big deal and early on. And they set protocols and standards early on. As soon as we left spring training, they were some of the first guys to cancel stuff. Send everybody home. We're not hanging around here. Just encompassing that whole process as I think back on it, that they were so up to date on the information. They were so ahead of like what was in the news even at times for me or even the things I was checked in on. So I think it started there and them setting the protocols and standards of making sure we're going to be the safest group in this downtime, and then working our way, how are we going to integrate everybody back in? It was very thought out, planned, great leadership on their part that just kind of fell into place. And then, you know, I think the touch that maybe I had that affected the guys was I just tried to talk about the unselfishness of when you have to make the tough decision, whether to go out and grab a beer or, you know, it's hard to be stuck inside all the time and just go home. Some guys didn't have any family there, but some guys did have family there. And Craig Kimbrell has a daughter that's had numerous heart surgeries before she's turned 3 or 4 years old. And we've got guys that are living with parents that have asthma problems or lung problems. And like I started listing off some of the guys and their family members that had some issues, and guys are on the, you know, cusp of, you know, thinking about maybe checking out on the season, or, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty going into that. And so we had to navigate those waters carefully, and we did. And it's about those guys being accountable to one another is really what I put on them. And they held up their end of the bargain, and you see how it how well we did and kind of, you know, getting, being able to be the only team that did that. I'm super, super proud of that. And it's all about them.
I'll give you a quick Theo story and just how on top of things he is and was. Going through the first 3 weeks of spring training, you know, we were broadcasting every day. And obviously I knew about the pandemic, but I wasn't on it every day. I would just see a headline here or there, right? And so I think it was the Monday of that week, we had a game in Scottsdale against the Giants, and that's when stuff started to really happen, and the media were not allowed in the clubhouses. And so JD and I kind of had an idea that something may be coming. So the day everything shut down was March 12th or 13th, right? And I interviewed Theo right after spring training had been stopped. And he absolutely insisted on 6 feet of social distancing, which was still something that we didn't really know about. So he was way ahead of it that way. And after the interview, I said, yeah, I don't know what to do. I'm just, you know, 2 weeks. Or he goes, go home mid-June at the earliest.
Yeah.
I mean, Rossi, he was so far ahead of it. He knew exactly. And it's exactly what you said. Like, he was telling everyone, get out of here. You know, this thing is serious as a heart attack. And I was really impressed at how far ahead of the news he was.
Yeah, he was leading. We had our leadership Zooms. And as you know, you realize you get the seat and how much work those guys do up there and directing, whether it's like international guys, scouts, minor leagues, like travel, getting guys back to their country, their homes, their families, visas. I mean, there was so much going on. I'm listening for the first time and all these, you know, these Zoom meetings that we're having at home. I'm like, man, how does this guy get any rest? But you're exactly right. He was on top. I remember, I think I said something about, well, can't we just do this or that on some subject? And it was literally, we got off the phone. He sent me like 7 articles on like indoors and eating and just all this different stuff. I mean, it was, and then you read it and you're like, wow, you know. So that's where that leadership that we're definitely going to miss. Jed's in on that too. Jed's, yep. You know, well prepared and has been doing a long time. But just those their leadership really stood out to me, and how much is on their plate on a daily basis was really cool to see, and how they handled that.
You're not a doctor, but do you think you had COVID? You said you had the worst flu you've ever had in your life.
And it was like, Doc Adams swears to me no, because I tested positive for influenza A. So he said he definitely had the flu, but my lungs burned so bad. Like something like razor blades in my chest. And the couple people I've talked to that have had it say it's really, really hard on your lungs. So I'm sticking with Doc and saying no, but there's that, you know, there's that like part of my brain, like you had something different. Cause I would the fever and the cough. Cause I never threw up. I never had any, you know, stomach issues. It was just my lungs and a really bad fever.
What was the line, JD? Lou Gehrig, you are not. I just remember you and I were just like, can you believe this? Rossi is not managing the first game of his career.
Yeah.
I told him karma, but you know what? Because he got it right out. He got the flu right after that. He did a couple of days. Nobody talks about that. He said that on TV.
Well, I had the flu in March too. And we're finding out that COVID was around earlier in different parts of the country than we realized. One of our camera guys, Wynn, said he had COVID. He was working in Japan last October and had tested positive. So,
oh wow,
yeah, it's crazy. So, I guess to the last one on COVID, what was the big thing that you couldn't do that really is essential in the big picture for you as a manager moving forward, understanding that some of those things still may be in place to start next season?
I think just the, you know, and we were a pretty loose group, but, you know, like the mask on, talking to your players is never like a great, you know, vibe. There were a couple of times I was got a little and, you know, excited, I guess, or emotional, and kind of ripped my mask down and just said, screw it, in a big, big outdoor venue. But, you know, I think the main thing really is on the player side. Like, they work so hard. You need release. You need to go on after a Sunday day game. You need to go to a bar and have some beers and watch football, or just be able to go to a nice dinner. It's a great thing about Chicago is the day games and going to dinner and different things like that. I thought that was, you know, there was, it felt like work all the time. Like, you know, I know it was a 60 game season, but to a man, everybody you talk to, it felt like a 200 game season. If you ask each guy, what that felt like. But as a manager, I think you're waiting for something to go wrong every second. I can't tell you how many times early on Theo called me at 7 a.m. when the test would come in during summer camp and, okay, we've got a inconclusive on this guy and that guy, or you're an inconclusive and you got to stay home until we go down to Northwestern, get tested. You know, this guy, you know, what, just something new every day. Well, KB, there was one day that we sent him home. He had a stomach ache, but that's one of the symptoms, right? And we're like, well, maybe it was just bad barbecue. You know what I mean? Like, maybe it just wasn't some good food we had the night before. But yeah, I mean, just, you're walking on pins and needles and waiting for the ball to drop any minute. And so there's just that added, anytime somebody walks in, especially if it's Theo, Jed, PJ, Doc Adams, any of the trainers or doctors walk into my office, I'm just like holding my breath that something, you know, could just be like, hey, you know, so-and-so is good to go. And sometimes I'd get good news, but you're just kind of waiting for some bad stuff to drop.
So looking forward, what is your best guess? How many games are going to play in 2021?
Man, I really don't know, JD. I'm planning for 162. I'm seeing the spikes a little bit around the country, and what this cold weather might bring is a little bit scary. But you know, there's the rumors of the vaccine coming and when that might be in place. I really trust in our leadership and then the leadership of Major League Baseball to kind of direct us on that. But everything that they're telling us is on time. And as much as that's maybe hard to believe, that's how I'm gonna set my mind. And I don't ever want to be surprised. It's always easier to slow down for me than try to catch up. So we're going to plan like things are go ahead until they tell us to pause.
How's the media stuff? Because when you become a manager, you realize you got to do like 300 things with the media, one before the game, one after the game. I thought you handled it really well, but there are times when I know you want to be honest and you want to be transparent, but especially with all the COVID stuff, like you can't be, right?
Yeah, you can't be. I appreciate you saying that because I don't ever know how I come off. I definitely feel like we've got a great, media group. They really are, you know, I know them as a player, so maybe I like them a little more than maybe some managers, but we've got good guys and girls that are around there, and so I enjoy those conversations. It's nice to try to dictate the narrative and talk about the things that you believe in and how hard the game is and how hard the guys work. But yeah, sometimes you have to keep stuff close to the vest because it's just one is just maybe against the law to say certain medical stuff. And then you can't tell them everything. And, you know, that's hard for me. I try to be an honest guy and I'm pretty open book for most people. So, I thought they handled me well. I thought I was a grumpy old man a couple of times, in those things. And I thought it went pretty well. I mean, I feel like I've got a great group to work with. So, you know, that was a good test run, 60 games. It's not 120. Maybe I'll be tired after 162 or something, but and plus, but I didn't mind it at all. Like Peter Chase and Jason Carr are phenomenal PR guys. Peter's gone now, but off to better things. But I'm super thankful for their leadership and their guidance in being able to navigate that for me, because it was very new and it can be intimidating if you don't have somebody that can kind of put things in perspective for you.
You know, I've talked to a number of managers over the years. Larry Durker in particular comes to mind. He wanted to be second guest after a game. He wanted to be asked a hard question so he could explain why he did what he did. And there would be times where I'd be playing golf with him the next day and he'd be like, I can't believe they didn't ask me about that, you know, such and such a move. Did you have a situation like that where you got done with the media and said, I can't believe they didn't, you know, call me out or at least ask my opinion why I did? And it must be really frustrating if they don't ask and then they write, Rossi did this wrong or this happened and it should have, you know, and you never had the chance to explain yourself. So what's your take on that?
I didn't feel like I got, you know, I try not to read too much. You know, I've got a group text with some buddies that'll send me some stuff every once in a while. And most of the time it's positive or, you know, the team acting the fool in the dugout, but sometimes it's an article, blasting me. And so they'll start poking fun at me.
Join the club, Rossi. We're all in that group. Don't worry.
Actually, to clean it up, you know? I don't remember the topic, but I remember there were a few times when I walked out and me and Peter, you know, we kind of, you know, he would help me prep before and we would kind of talk before we go in. And a couple of times it would just be like, I'd come out and I'm like, man, I can't believe they didn't ask me about this. Or the other. So there's for sure those times that come in, but other things pop up on their radar. You know, you realize like they've got some stories that they want to get out or are working on. You know, I know the Schwarber thing got a ton of attention and that was a little, that was like the first pause I had as a manager when that kind of like, sure. You know, that got a little hairy and having to answer to them. And then they follow up with the player and you never know how that's going to go. I hadn't even got a chance to talk to Kyle yet. And so just, it's a lot of that, that you realize you've got to be prepared for and kind of ahead of, at times.
We have a couple more minutes with Rossi or David or the skipper. And JD, you have a hard hitting. We saved the hard hitting question for last. So I'll let you ask.
Yeah. So, who, if anybody, calls you Dave? Or Dave, you're always David or Rossi. You're never Dave. I mean, what's the deal?
I'm not a big fan of Dave. The only one I think I'll fix. I think my dad was Big Dave. So like I saved that for my dad. He's David Ross as well. We have different middle names, but that's Big Dave. So I don't mind anything, but the Dave is it just makes me feel like so weird. I don't know. I don't like
No.
Totally understandable. You said, don't call me Ross, right? It's Rossi or David. No Ross.
Listen, I learned in this job, there's a lot more names that I'm gaining.
do you take umbrage if somebody were to call you coach and not skipper?
No, because I realized that not everybody is as in tune with baseball knowledge or the ranking. Right. All that. So I get that. Actually, around my hometown, people say they coach around here because they're used to like Bobby Bowden walks around here and a bunch of football coaches with two universities here. And so the coach thing, it makes me laugh on the inside because they don't know, but I got no ego and all.
I played for Hal Lanier in Houston and Hal hated that. And he actually put a sign up above his desk. I'm not the coach. I'm the manager.
I remember when I first got drafted and you go in and you call your anybody coach, right? Like any of the real coaches or the manager, and they say, no, my name's David or my name's Bill or my, like, you know, they didn't want to be called any of that stuff. They want to be called by their first name in pro ball. I know that was a big stickler from the guys I came up with and who were teaching me. In the minor leagues, that was like rule number one, don't call me coach.
Yeah, and don't call an umpire Blue. I don't know if you remember that one when you're coming out of college and you're playing pro ball, and you're, hey, Blue, and they just kind of, Blue? Where's Tom, you know?
Yeah.
All right, last one, and you mentioned your relationship with Jed, and he's going to be a terrific president of baseball operations. But last question, again, I'm not giving you a lot of time here, so it's not fair, but your relationship with Theo and how much he's meant to you.
Oh man, listen, like this guy changed my entire path of my career. And, talking about some guys that have had influence on just my overall, how I got to where I am now, like Theo Epstein is at the top of that list outside of maybe some, with my dad, you know, who helped, the reason I'm here. He has the ability to speak some truths to you in a way that you can take ownership of in your career and in your life and who you want to be. And the fact that he has always been open and honest in an era and a time when that wasn't the case, and talking to players and talking to them about how they saw them when everything was a big secret, when I was kind of coming up and throughout most of my career, he was the first guy to tell me about a reputation that I had. I've written about it in my book, but just, you know, for those who hadn't heard the story, just, you know, I came in, I got released by Cincinnati, had a couple options. Theo picked me up after I cleared waivers and brought me on to Boston, promised me to call me up before September deadline so I could get free agency. I mean, no other team would do that. So I signed with Boston, and at the end of it, made a good run. He called me in the office, just told me my reputation wasn't that great, that he hadn't seen that since I had been in Boston, but that my reputation some other places wasn't good. And that's what I heard. And he just thought I should know that. And from that day forward, I made a point to make sure I was never considered a selfish player or person and a team guy. And I changed that narrative for the good. And it's thanks to him. And then he brings me on to Chicago with John and give me some real truths on that and being able, you know, let me celebrate the back end of my career after a terrible season, a bad ending to Boston. I was awful in my last year there and thought my baseball career might be over. And then I ride John Lester's coattails to a 2-year deal in a World Series that has changed my life for sure. And to go on and then to hire me and be able to be a special assistant and now have the job I have, I'm pretty thankful.
Well, he left you in good stead. And as he said, he'll still call you and text you and second guess you, which is awesome.
He's going to be blowing me up, that's for sure.
All right, Coach. Thanks for that. Happy holidays. We can't wait to see you in person in a couple of months. Thanks for joining us. Great stuff today.
Yeah, thanks, Lance. I love listening to you guys' stuff. It's really good.
Thanks, Rossi.
Great stuff, as always, from Cubs manager David Ross. JD, I'm always struck by his sense of, I guess, self-awareness, which sometimes can be lacking in that position and in this industry. But the Theo story really still resonates, the fact that he needed to make a change, and he did. And I guess the irony of that is, and you can tell me otherwise, but I've never heard that he's been a bad teammate since the day he got to Chicago.
Yeah, I guess we'd have to, you know, do some digging at earlier in his career, because he seems like the ultimate teammate. You know, has such great leadership qualities. It is kind of ironic to, you know, and I've heard that story before, as you have, the fact that he was considered by some to be a bad teammate, maybe a little selfish. But as we've said from day one when he got hired, he checks all the boxes. And for a guy that had never managed before, to have to go through the year that he did, the COVID protocols, just a really job well done, and Cubs are in a great position going forward, I think, with Rossi at the helm.
And we didn't get a chance to ask him, but I think the other thing you in particular appreciated about his first go-around is that the very first game he ever managed, and I suppose you could claim that it was an easy call, but he let his starting pitcher finish the game. And you know, that's not something that happens very often, especially with the whole narrative around the end of July that none of the starting pitchers in the league were stretched out.
Yeah,
but letting Kyle finish that game was really cool.
Yeah, there were a lot of pitchers that they weren't going to go more than 3 innings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, you know, he was keeping a close watch on the pitch count. But all the while, you know, with Hendricks out there, the way he pitches, I think he felt pretty comfortable letting him go. But yeah, it's just another one of those tough situations to be put in as a first-year manager.
And one other one, I thought he handled Craig Kimbrell not only in the media in terms of being asked about his struggles early on, but really in keeping him in the mix and having Kimbrell by the end of the year again become one of the essentially top 2 relievers on the team with Jeremy Jeffress. That thing could have really gone sideways after early on some of the same problems he had experienced the year before, but he got better as the year went on. And I give his manager a lot of credit for that too.
Yeah. And you know, there had to have been some hard conversations down there in that clubhouse between those two, because Kimbrel is, you know, one of the best closers ever. And I'm sure, you know, his mindset at the time was probably, look, I'm going to be all right, you know, keep leaning on me. And Rossi was like, no, we're going to, you know, take you out of the fire here a little bit and kind of rehab you mentally. And it worked. And he came back and he was at the top of his game. So that's always a big challenge for any manager. And again, for a guy first year going through it, that would, you know, prove to be a really shining example of he just has good touch. He's really good with people and he knows the game, obviously.
All right. I've got the Dixon Baseball Dictionary on my desk. Give me a letter and we'll dive into a couple of baseball terms.
Well, let's go right off the top. Let's go to the letter A.
You're going to make it easy on me. Yeah. By the way, this book is 990 some pages. So it's a big book. Ooh, this is good. All right. AstroTurf. You know it well. The brand name for one of the earliest and most popular forms of artificial turf. Got its name from the Astrodome, the former home of your team, the Houston Astros. By the time you got to the big leagues, I want to say half the league had AstroTurf, right? A lot of the all-purpose stadiums. We're now down to Tampa, and actually a couple of places have added artificial stuff. The new ballpark in Texas, I want to say Miami, because they feel like they perfected it to a degree where a lot of the retractable roof ballparks, they feel like it's easier to maintain.
Yeah, they've created a substance that mimics grass much better than the original AstroTurf did. And in the dome, by the time I got there, there was all these weird seams in the turf and the ball would take crazy bounces. And, you know, a ground ball to the left of the shortstop, this turf would be so fast, it would end up in the gap. It'd go for a triple sometimes. And I'm sure you know the story. The dome originally had a clear roof and the grass wouldn't grow. They couldn't see the ball because of the bright sky overhead. So they painted the roof, killed the grass, and they said, uh-oh, we need to fix this. Monsanto developed the AstroTurf. And yeah, by the time when I was in the National League, it seemed like just about all the stadiums were artificial turf.
Yeah. Was there anything about artificial turf as a pitcher that was beneficial, or was it all a benefit to the offense?
Yeah, it helped offense, certainly. I guess you could argue, because if you were a fly ball pitcher like I was, you might have a slight advantage over a ground ball pitcher, because ground balls on turf, obviously, we're not going to get slowed down like they would on grass. But no, you know, it was so fast. I don't think there was any real advantage for pitchers with turf.
Okay, one other baseball term, starting with the letter A, artist. An accomplished baseball player in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And the second definition would be a skilled pitcher. Tom Glavine used as an example. You're very good at using terminology that's not related to baseball specifically, that fits in nicely. And I think painting and artistry, that really does kind of, quote, paint quite a visual for fans, not only on television, but radio as well. And artistry, that works. And I think of Kyle Hendricks.
Yeah, well, right? Immediately when you said artist, the first image that popped into my head is Greg Maddux. Mm-hmm. And Greg Maddux always leads us to Kyle Hendricks. It's the, you know, the artistry. And sometimes, you know, power guys get left out of that conversation because we think of finesse pitchers being artists. Obviously, the great ones are both. They're power pitchers who have great. Tom Seaver comes to mind, right? A power pitcher who had great control and great pitching acumen. But yeah, Maddux is kind of the signature guy, and in the modern game, the active guy would be Kyle Hendricks.
And I think the position player comp in terms of artistry would be Javi Baez, Fernando Tatis Jr., Nolan Arenado, guys like that, right? Brooks Robinson back in the day, kind of the real athletic, artistic, defensive plays and magical plays around the bag.
Yeah, great defenders. And you think about the artistry, Andrew Jones in the outfield comes to mind, of turning into the Wayback Machine, a kid guy I watched as a kid, Mark Belanger at shortstop. Kind of a graceful, you know, Javi, so graceful around the bag, and makes so many, and not just with Baez, it's not just defensively, it's base running too, with the slides and all the trickery.
Well, happy 93rd birthday to the greatest broadcaster ever, Vin Scully. We hope you had a great Thanksgiving. Happy holiday season. When does the Christmas tree go up, JD?
Well, we have a little one up right now. I think we're like a lot of people with the pandemic. We're kind of pushing the season a little bit. So we don't have a great big one here that we may ultimately go out and buy a new one. But we have a little one up. And Lori and Molly yesterday made this unbelievable gingerbread house. So we're buying in. We're inland. We're all in.
I love it.
How about you guys?
Ours will probably go up a couple weeks before Christmas. But we're listening to Christmas music already on XM. So that's
it.
Getting us in the holiday spirit for sure. Special thanks, Big Jim Obojkowicz, Shane McGuire, Joe Rios, Matt Romito, Daniel Green, Adam Sobel. For Jim Deshaies, I'm Len Casper. Subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast with your friends. And we will talk to you soon on Open Concessions, presented by Toyota.